Hello and welcome to A Radio Geekly, an hour-long insight into the realm of geekdom. I'm Just Jess, and I will be your guide for the next 60 minutes. So strap yourselves in, beam yourselves up, and blast off with us into another exciting adventure. Good morning, and thanks for joining us here on this premiere pilot episode of A Radio Geekly. Yay! Woohoo! Radio Geekly is a collective consisting of geeks from all perspectives who have joined together to discuss all things geek. Everything from comic books, TV shows, movies, fandoms, gaming, and more. These geeks will have something to say about it, and myself included. Today's episode, we'll be talking about fandoms, and we'll be taking your input later on in the show. So if you have something to say about fandoms, maybe what your favorite fandom is, please call 503-231-8187, and we'll chat with you. Today, I'm joined in the studio by some of my fellow geeks, Becky, Jenna, and David. Welcome to all of you.
Hello.
Thank you.
Hi. Why don't each of you take a second and describe your fandom, maybe one or two that you enjoy being a fan of. And Jenna, why don't you kick us off?
I am a huge Star Trek nerd and a Futurama nerd, and I think that those two things go together just beautifully. They're the best things. Anything you guys say, it's just wrong.
Well, I think we can peacefully coexist. I am I part of the fandom of role playing Dungeons and Dragons, and oh, my name is Becky. Dang, thanks.
I didn't know you were a DOD.
Yeah. Learning so much.
Been playing for almost all of my adult life and some of the younger part too, but I love all sorts of TV shows, the fandoms associated with that. I could go on, but yeah, gaming is my deal, but like the old school kind, the paper, pencil, no electronics. We use candles. And no air conditioning.
And D20s.
D20s, right? Endless D20s.
Okay. And David.
Yeah, this is David, and I would say my fandom for The Simpsons goes back to basically when it started in the early 90s. My dog tags actually had my original, my official listed religion was The Simpsons. I went out of my way to get the commander to do that for me.
That's awesome.
Good.
Futurama carries right into that. Star Wars is winning me back. The 2000s, the aughts, really, I had to turn my back on that.
Mm. Oh, really?
As a lot of
I had
to
pretend I wasn't a fan. And it was like that embarrassing, weird just period of my life.
It still existed in your heart, though, right? Yeah, you can admit that now.
It's still hard, but you know,
I think a lot of Star Wars fans these days, it's like you went away, you lost the faith, now you're trying to rebuild the faith.
Yes.
But there's still a little hesitation.
There is.
I feel it.
I think that's a whole other topic, though. We can go on for
days. Its own show.
It is its own show.
Yeah, we've been doing a lot of brainstorming and workshopping in the minutes coming up to this.
Yeah, so if you listeners enjoy what you like to hear, maybe we'll get a little Star Wars action in future episodes. But for now, I'm going to stick to my favorite fandom. I'm a big Harry Potter nerd, and I've been reading them since the early 2000s. So I kind of grew up with Harry Potter in a way, and I made a little piece about my fandom on there. So let's take a listen to it and hope you guys enjoy.
Fandom, the state or attitude of being a fan. Fan, an abbreviation of fanatic, meaning marked by excessive enthusiasm and often intense uncritical devotion. Now this term is widely used in several areas of our lives. Sports, music, television, books? Yes, I mean those ink and paper masterpieces that draw us into a story, introducing us to characters, and inviting us along for an epic ride. But can a fandom bring families together to engage in more than just sitting in front of a screen? Well, let me tell you about a fandom that did that and still does today, Harry Potter.
Thank you.
Although the franchise is as old as a college student, there's still plenty of hype going around today about the boy wizard and the world that he lives in. Why, just last month, author J.K. Rowling released Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, or what fans are calling Book 8 in the series. It is the script from the theater production that has been performed at the Palace Theater in London since June of 2016. And of course, I had to get a copy for myself. It continues the story of Harry's life, years later, where he's a father and is learning how to be a parent and experiencing the struggles that his children face. This theme can be relatable on so many levels, but what I found interesting is how children grew a better understanding of this world around them by reading the Harry Potter books. Harry Potter came onto the scene in America in the late 90s, when most notable children's books of the day were poetry and themes that seemed too complicated for a child to comprehend. Harry Potter bridged that gap by developing characters that had similar struggles and created scenarios that enabled the readers to grasp these concepts and understand them from a different perspective. In 2014, Scientific American posted an article discussing a recent study published by the Journal of Applied Social Psychology in which 34 elementary school children were given a questionnaire to complete after reading various passages in the Harry Potter books. The children were divided into two groups, one group reading passages that included themes of prejudice, like what are purebloods versus mudbloods.
Well, you all know, of course, that Hogwarts was founded over 1,000 years ago by the four greatest witches and wizards of the age. Godric Gryffindor, Helga Hufflepuff, Rowena Ravenclaw, and Salazar Slytherin. Now, three of the founders coexisted quite harmoniously. One did not.
Three guesses, huh?
Salazar Slytherin wished to be more selective about the students admitted to Hogwarts. He believed magical learning should be kept within all magic families. In other words, purebloods. Unable to sway the others, he decided to leave the school. Now, according to legend, Slytherin had built a hidden chamber in this castle known as the Chamber of Secrets. Well, shortly before departing, he sealed it until that time when his own true heir returned to the school. The heir alone would be able to open the chamber and unleash the horror within, and by so doing, purge the school of all those who, in Slytherin's view, were unworthy to study magic.
And the second group were given passages to read with lighter themes, like when Harry purchased his first wizarding wand.
The wand chooses the wizard, Mr. Potter. It's not always clear why, but I think it is clear can expect great things from you. After all, he who must not be named did great things. Terrible. But great.
The attitudes of the children in the first group were radically changed after reading these passages, while the second group with the simpler passages showed no change in their attitudes. To quote Scientific American, reading novels as a child, implying literary engagement with social, cultural, psychological complexities, can have a positive impact on personality development and social skills, unquote. Professor Loris Fazzali of the University of Modena, who conducted this survey, stated, "Fantasy may be especially effective in assuaging negative attitudes because the genre typically doesn't feature actual populations, and thus avoids potential defensiveness and sensitivities around political correctness. But, based upon our work here, fantasy books such as Harry Potter may be of great help to educators and to parents in teaching tolerance." Unquote. So by creating this realm of tolerance, how did parents become involved in reading Harry Potter? Well, when they saw their children sitting on the couch, not watching television or playing video games, I'm sure that curiosity rose.
Why are you wearing glasses?
Reading.
Reading? I didn't know you could read.
And with talks in the mainstream media of a children's story about a boy wizard studying witchcraft, there were bound to be parents wanting to inquire about this Harry Potter business. And yes, when there are those that wanted to ban Harry Potter from libraries and schools because of those themes, J.K. Rowling herself stated in an interview, "People have the right to decide what they want their children to read, but in my opinion, they do not have the right to tell other people's children what they should read." Unquote. Also, there's enough evidence to prove that Harry Potter is merely fantasy and will not turn your child into the next member of the occult. According to Ren Walker, a practicing witch and co-founder of The Witch's Voice, a group for witches and Wiccans worldwide, Harry Potter offers a lighthearted view of witchcraft and wizardry and does not glorify violence, advance witchcraft, or promote anti-family sentiments. Unquote. For me personally, Harry Potter gives parents a platform to discuss themes like prejudice, diversity, tolerance, good versus evil, in a way that can be more relatable to their child than in an everyday news story. And it is quite clear that with over 400 million copies of Harry Potter sold worldwide, this story is creating more fans and creating quite the fandom that will spread for many years to come. I hope I can pass this on to my children and start building another world of positivity as they dive into this fantastical story. This is Just Jess for Radio Geekly.
Oh, I just love Harry Potter. So glad I get to read book 8 soon. Yay! Are any of you guys Harry Potter fans?
Yes. I'm not as big of a geek as you, but I mean, I definitely like when every single one of the books came out, mm-hmm. I was like in high school and college when they came out, and I was all ditching school and work. Like I would pre-plan. I was like, okay, book release is on March 3rd, so I need to take March 3rd and 4th off from work. Like I pre-planned it like 6 weeks in advance.
Wow, that's
I got
so
people
to
cover my shift. I know. But I didn't want to be getting any sort of like calls. I was like, shut myself into a little box and just like binge read these books.
Right.
So good.
Yeah. I was, my friend told me about the movies that were coming out. And so I was trying to read the books in conjunction with when the movies came out. And I was behind in the books. And she's like, yeah, movie 5 is coming out, so you have 2 weeks to read up to book 5.
That's a lot of pressure.
And I was like, yeah. And for those of you who don't know, each book gets exponentially larger as it goes on in the
series.
So
book 5, so you're at 1,000 pages.
Yeah,
you have 2 weeks to read it.
It's cool. It's fine. But I totally did. I barreled through and made
it. Wait, you read 5 books?
Uh-huh.
In 2 weeks?
It was something like two and a half weeks. Yeah, whoa. It was insane.
Were you like Clockwork Orange? Were you just like dripping, like eye drops in your eyes just to read?
Don't talk to me.
No.
Yeah. So, no, it was awesome. And I'm excited to read book 8. I haven't started yet, so. Uh-huh. No, but there's no spoilers in that piece.
When
I
is it coming out?
It's already out.
It's already out? Yeah. Oh, see, this is how. Yeah.
I think Jesse has the book.
I have
in
it.
Hand.
Isn't it a play, though?
It is. It's actually the script, but J.K. Rowling is calling it like a continuation of the Harry Potter story.
It's like he's older and he actually has children.
Right, yeah. So it's just their. Him being a parent and that side of things.
Like an epilogue, would you think?
As an epilogue?
Yeah, like is that what you call it? At the end of a story where it tells you like, oh, and then 20 years down the road.
It just wasn't satisfying enough to just see them sending their kids off to Hogwarts. It was like, wait.
Yeah.
I was looking at one of the articles about it in Entertainment Weekly, and I thought it was interesting looking at the cast they had for the play.
Mm-hmm.
And Hermione's and Ron's daughter is African-American from what I can tell, which I thought was an interesting.
Yeah, I thought it was really cool that the diversity is actually like being shown in a theater form and not necessarily like described in the books. But I thought that was really cool. It's like, yeah, go diversity, POC.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's really cool. Well, I know another form of ink and paper media is comic books.
Oh, yeah.
I know you guys are comics or graphic novel enthusiasts of some sort.
Oh, absolutely. Deep appreciation all around the table for the graphic arts and story form.
Yeah. So next clip I wanted to play was an interview with David Walker. He's a comic book artist and developer, and he actually did an interview with our PM News director, Lisa Loving. And in this clip, he talks about writing his comics, who his themed audience is and kind of what he hopes to come across in developing these stories, like who is his audience and what was his agenda, for lack of a better term, in when he's producing the comics. So let's take a listen to that interview with Lisa Loving and David Walker.
Here's another thing. So you just talked about our, as a society, our expanding understanding and awareness of people who are other than plain cisgendered men and women, right? We're beginning to understand who we really are. And it makes me wonder, who reads your comics? Are you aware of who reads them? Who is your community of readers? Because I'm guessing there's going to be all of our friends that are struggling to be understood in society seem like people who would be reading your comics.
You know, I try to write my comics for everybody, but, you know, that I know that that's not the case. I especially have learned that the last few days, the amount of hate that's come my way, which is fine. I'm writing comics. If there's one person I'm writing comic books for, one person only, it's me at 12 years old. That's who I'm writing for. I'm writing for that kid who is suffering from a state of near constant alienation, but has never heard the term alienation, so doesn't know what it is that they're feeling. All they know is they feel they don't belong, and they're looking for some sort of guidance or some sort of inspiration. They're looking for characters that they can relate to. And for me, growing up, the characters that I related to in popular fiction and in film and in television and in comics, like 99.9% of the time, they were white men. And I realized as I was getting older that it hadn't changed that much. And when I was going through my midlife crisis, which coincided with a career crisis of what do I want to do with my life now that I've hit 40, and I realized, well, the one thing I always wanted to do when I was a kid was I wanted to write comics. This is what I always wanted to do more than anything else. And I was fortunate enough to know people and to have the tenacity to pursue a career fairly late in life, and to ignore the people who said, you're too old to do this. And I was saying it to myself. You know, you turn 40. 40 does not seem like a good time to switch careers. But I did. And I don't regret that. And so every day I get emails and messages from people running the gamut. I get messages from parents saying, you know, oh, my 10-year-old is reading your comic. And I sometimes think, I don't know if it's appropriate for a 10-year-old. But I'm going to trust you that you're a good enough parent to know what's proper and what's inappropriate for your kid. But more than anything, I think I realize now that I'm writing for people who just are looking for a place to hide for a little while. Isn't that what popular entertainment is more than anything? They're looking for a place to hide from the world. They're looking for a distraction. I happen to write distractions that address some of the issues that are going on in the real world, but within a context that empowers people who feel powerless. And even people with power feel powerless, and that's the problem. We all feel that we're lacking it. And the thing is that there's you and I can sit here and we're in positions of privilege just by the fact that there's microphones in front of our face, right? But then there's people who we look at and who have privilege over us and have power over us. And it's all about keeping that perspective, which is really difficult to do, especially when you're younger. And it's also difficult to do when you just voluntarily have blinders on.
I want to shift the frame for a second and say, what's your agenda?
My agenda. Well, people have been accusing me of a lot of things as of late, and I have one agenda. I have two agendas. First is to entertain people, and the second is to give young people permission to dream of a better world and work towards that by whatever means they feel they can do. I'm a little bit older, a little bit more tired than I was when I was in my 20s and 30s and a real loudmouth, and I'm not thoroughly convinced that I can make the world a better place. And so what I do is I write stories that are set in worlds that are better places. And my only goal is to give somebody a safe haven for a little while. So you don't have to turn on CNN or MSNBC or Fox and be terrified by the real world, or not even the real world, but by this presentation again that these fearmongers peddle to us, and they sell it to us and we consume it. I want to give you a place of where maybe there's some violence and there's some danger, but there's also a little bit of hope at the end. And in doing that, and by stepping forth and going, hey, look, I'm a kid who was raised by a single mom on welfare. I'm a person of color. By saying that I did this and I made a choice to do this later in life and I'm, you know, middle-aged, I'm giving you all permission to dream. And the thing is with there's a lot of kids in America who are being denied permission to dream for a whole host of reasons. It's budget cuts, or it's racism, or it's sexism, or it's homophobia. It's girls aren't supposed to do this, or blacks aren't supposed to do this, or queer folks aren't supposed to do this. And their dreams are being extinguished. And what are we if nothing but, you know, what our dreams drive us to become? And so that's my agenda. My agenda is just to make, you know, some black kid or some queer kid or some little girl who everybody around them is and everything around them is telling them they can't do it. And I'm here to say, yeah, you can, you know, and to get myself maybe in a position where I can, you know, at some point, like, you know, whatever, bring them in, on board, bring them into a publisher, or go, you know, okay, rent has been paid for this month. I can write a check to you for $50 or whatever and help you self-publish whatever you want to do. Or I can just share it with the world. I mean, that's just it. It's like, we're all in this together. You know, it's the great, we're all on the great big blue marble together on a boat. And if this boat sinks, ain't but so many lifeboats, you know, how are we going to get away from it all? And it's like, if all we're doing is killing each other, then there's nobody even left to get on the lifeboat. So what do you do?
David Walker, Nighthawk, Power Man and Iron Fist, thanks so much for coming in and talking with us this afternoon.
Thanks for having me. It's always good to see you. You know, it's this is the great thing about living in Portland. So thank you for having me.
What a powerful agenda, yeah. Stated by David Walker. I mean, entertainment and empowerment are such an important part of media equity, right?
Right.
But also, you know, in this way that you know, inspires people to dream, especially young people who have, like, no representation, really. So I think that part's really great. What a powerful interview, really.
I know, that was so good. Go, Lisa.
Yeah, there's more to listen to. So if you're interested, you can email us. Email Jesse, Jessy, @kboo.org, and you can get some of these links and even little snippets from what we're playing today. So, yeah, if you're just tuning in, this is the premiere pilot episode of A Radio Geekly. Yay. I'm Jess, and I'm here with Jenna, Becky, and David. And, Hi. Yes, I totally agree, Becky, with what you're saying about empowering those that didn't think that they could do something like that, you know, mm-hmm. just because of society and, you know, prevention and things like that. So that's really cool how he kind of develops a lot of these stories, like as if he was talking to his younger self.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the really cool things about fandoms in general is that they are that empowerment piece. You can sort of take inspiration from, you know, like the base canon of something and then expand it to no limit. Like, the universe is the limit, and there's no limit to that. So having, you know, an infinite amount of different stories, different characters, you know, the values that come from that is so cool. Like, the empowering part, especially amongst fandoms with younger participants, mm-hmm. and having a community that's already built in on a number of different platforms is incredible.
What he had to say just seems so at the heart of what is geekdom to me. Mm-hmm. You know, it's this embracing of we're all different, and we all actually are all kind of unempowered people who need to find our own voices and, mm-hmm. you know, raising that up, whatever that is to you. And I think that's why we're also attracted to stories like X-Men or, you mm-hmm. know, all these graphic or the superhero stories, mm-hmm. you know, it's about yeah. these people who are unnoticed and find their voice, mm-hmm. you know, and that's like every geekdom. It's
so
great. It's so
wish fulfillment. It's totally true.
Yeah, right. So I really like that he's just super geek.
Oh, yeah, totally. Our people.
Yeah, and I know that those kind of stories can also be developed in different sorts of media. So not only in books and, mm-hmm. like, graphic novels and things like that, but also in video games. Mm-hmm. And so I know that our next piece is from a piece from one of our collective. His name goes by Light Phoenix. And he talks about the history of gaming in terms of like how it got developed and the culture around it and actually the explosion and how it kind of hit the ground running. And there's a lot of people that kind of got involved in games and stuff. And we were just talking while we were listening to the David Walker piece, Jenna, about, you know, Super Mario Brothers and how it's more than just a plumber, you know, like he actually was fighting evil. You know, if you want to look at the overall arch of the story from the Mario
Brothers.
He
was saving the overworld and the underworld.
Exactly.
Yeah,
a lot of
exactly.
Stuff to do.
There was no difference between land and sea and the icy wastelands, you know? Except they were never wastelands. Like they were still like super vibrant and
right.
Lots of enemies to get crushed by or crush.
Yeah. But then you got back up and you did it again.
Yeah.
So you had to save the day one mm-hmm. way or another.
Or save your game.
Exactly.
Yeah, exactly.
Make sure to save your
God
game.
God bless when save happens.
I know.
Oh, man. So let's take a listen to Light Phoenix's piece about gaming.
Though gaming as a concept has a slightly deeper history, many gamers will agree that the birth of a true video gaming fandom occurred in the early 1980s, when the ever-growing popularity of Atari and the rising numbers of coin-op arcades collided and thrust gaming into the face of the mainstream. At first, the goings were pretty slow, with the main demographic being older high schoolers to younger college students, as well as fans of the Atari's predecessors, such as the Magnavox Odyssey or the Fairchild F, as well as a large number of D&D and tabletop gaming enthusiasts. But as the market expanded to involve educational and family-friendly titles, the customer base swelled, and video games became a commonplace household accoutrement, with the Atari brand leading the pack through the first and second generations of console gaming. In 1983, though, due to a large number of factors, including the rise of PCs over consoles in terms of gaming potential, and an abundance of poorly designed third-party titles for the Atari, the video game retail market in the US had been all but eliminated. Meanwhile, in Japan, they had caught on to the massive popularity of video gaming and begun designing a console beyond anything that had been released in the US so far. And soon, the Nintendo Famicom, which stood for Family Computer, was born. And over the short course of 2 years, it was repackaged and redesigned as the Nintendo Entertainment System, and after a short market trial received by the American public with a powerful fervor, the third generation of gaming, known as the 8-bit era, had finally begun. It was then that communities really started to grow, and fandoms pertaining to specific games or for specific franchises started to crop up. Local public and private tournaments began being held from people and establishments for all sorts of competitive titles, from Mortal Kombat to Pac-Man. If it had competitive value, people wanted to know who was the best in their community. And with that, the birth of true, formal gaming competition set the stage for modern-day competitive gaming. With the rise of the fifth generation, 3D gaming was born, which expanded gaming corporations, offering up lots of new jobs that required entirely new designing skill sets and further improving gaming quality, as well as ramping up the level of competition for gamers, completely redesigning how they played games and franchises they had up until then been completely familiar with. In 1997, what is widely referred to as the first instance of a true esports competition occurred. The Red Annihilation Tournament for the first-person shooter title Quake was a groundbreaking event, which drew a crowd of around 2,000 people, with the grand prize of the tournament being a Ferrari previously owned by Quake's lead developer. A few short weeks later, one of the first major gaming leagues was founded, the Cyber Athlete Professional League. These guys, as well as a few other initial gaming leagues, paved the way for the release of the Major League Gaming Association in 2002, which ballooned and snowballed in its popularity, commanding competitions of every competitive genre from first-person shooting to real-time strategy. 10 years later, MLG had become such a mainstream thing that the Spring Championship boasted 4 million viewers, more even than the 2012 NBA All-Star Game. Today, with MLG contracts and sponsorship, YouTube and Twitch streams, and all of those delicious prize pools, pro gaming has become a way of life. And no one can deny that gaming has not only impacted, but forever altered the world we live in, ushering in new advances in science and technology. And with improved simulation, virtual reality, and augmented reality technology over the horizon, I'd say the future of gaming is looking pretty bright. This has been Light Phoenix, offering up a brief history on pro gaming and the surrounding fandom. Keep it weird, Portland.
That was Light Phoenix with his little brief history of gaming. And I didn't realize it's only been like 30 years since gaming's kind of come to, you know, the world.
Yeah, it's crazy how many different consoles we've seen come through, right? And the evolution.
I mean, like, if you could count every single video game or computer game that has, like, drifted across our consciousness, it probably numbers in tens, hundreds of thousands, I would even say.
Well, what was everybody's first console? Like, what was your first console, Becky?
I had the first-generation NES. That was the first thing that I had. We kind of bought older consoles after that point, but it was sort of like a question of access. We didn't really have a lot of money when I was a kid, so I got that after like 2 years of it being out, and I was so stoked.
Yeah, it was the same. I inherited my Super NES, but before that, I had inherited what was called an Intellivision.
Whoa.
Yeah. People don't even know. And it had like a cartridge, and the like game controllers looked kind of like a telephone, and you had like a number keypad.
Wow.
Yeah, and you had to like insert a card over it to like know what was going on.
Oh, and so that was the like how you could change it from the different games is like you put in the cartridge and then you'd have to change the
controller. This, well, you'd have a little card that you put on top of the controller, so each game with its own little card, so you would know what button to push.
Yeah.
Oh, Intellivision, such good stuff.
That's awesome. My mom was so against like having NES like in the house that she would hide it, and then I would sneak out of bed, like late at night, and then like plug it back in and play for like hours in the middle of the night.
I think our board operator Sam has some input on the. On the gaming here.
Well, my first console was the Atari 2600.
Yes!
Whoa.
I got at a garage sale.
For?
And I don't remember how much. I didn't buy it. I was like 8.
What was your game on it? You had to have at least one game. What was it?
Well, I had about... The thing is, there were a couple of cartridges that I think were thrown in. And then, if I'm remembering correctly, just like a few weeks later, there was another garage sale with a whole box of cartridges. So I got like 5 or 6 more.
Nice.
So gaming on a budget.
There you go.
That's how I got mine as well, a garage sale, 2600. Yeah.
And Atari too. Wow. Did you have a favorite game?
I like the Moon Patrol for some reason.
Okay.
I was all about the Pac-Man on the Atari. Like, even though you could play it like, you know, at the arcades and whatever, there's something about the Atari that was, it was so much easier and it was so good.
There was this weird Journey album that came out, Journey Escape. I wouldn't say weird, but like Don't Stop Believing was on it. Mm-hmm. I heard that song the first time, you know, well after it came out. And I'm going, wait a minute, this song, I know this song. It was an Atari game I used to play called... they had a tie-in when that album came out. They released Journey Escape, the Atari game. And I played that game, and it was one of those Atari games that you could actually beat.
Whoa.
And that's a crossover.
I love that game.
We need to find that.
I know. We need to play this.
Yeah. And then when I heard the Journey song, it all came back. Like, this is amazing. I love this song.
What a perfect song for like a game. Just, like, don't stop believing. Keep playing.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, games are meant to inspire like action, and you have like that productive, you know, victory or even loss part of it.
Right.
It gamification of different things, I'm sure, like came more into the forefront when people were playing games so much more often. Like, now I know how cool it is to like lose when I'm playing Super Monkey Ball. Like, that's super funny and cool. I'm going to do it again and again. And so like those concepts get applied to like corporate culture and like work and all these other things. So,
yeah. So there's kind of like an underlying tone of like you have this goal and you want to have like victory, you know, so you're like doing whatever you can to fight for whatever.
Gaming is an emotional journey.
It is.
Super emotional. You get super sucked into the story and just like every aspect of it. And it's so physical, and it just like it invades your dreams when you play a game too much.
Oh,
it's,
endorphins flood the system. You have all these great like party hormones in you. Like, oh, cool. Be stoked on the game. Yeah. I am.
It would be philosophical in a way to say it like inspires you in your everyday life by gaming.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, like, for a while I was a competitive gamer. I mean, and so it really did actually just, like, fuel my life for a while. Yeah. But, I mean, you get so stuck into whatever game it is that you're playing. Like, people who get sucked into Final Fantasy, oh, those people drive me nuts.
Oh, well,
you know, like, it's more than just about, like, the gameplay. They get super stuck into the story and the philosophy behind it and, right. like, and just, like, the deepness between, I don't know.
That is some intense fandom, for sure.
Is. And they are super intense.
That whole series just encourages, like, you know, like, the blossoming of universes every single time they release
that
something.
That one's evolved over console as well, right. You know, you've seen on different consoles and it looks a little bit different, and the different consoles have encouraged how the gameplay evolves.
Oh,
and
yeah.
So that's a really interesting one, since it's existed forever.
Yeah, and yeah,
why
the gameplay is
forever?
Oh my god. Okay, so I love that game.
Oh, no.
I'm definitely one of those people that have spent, like, you know, the normal gameplay for that, like Final Fantasy X, for example, was like 80 hours, and I spent, I think, 160, like at least double.
Did you dream about it?
Oh yeah, I dreamed about it. I spent every moment of my life for, like, at least a few months, like, playing that, like, oh, Waka, I love this, like, ball game that they have. And yeah,
did you get sad, like, when the sad music would come on and
oh
stuff?
Oh my god,
did you, like,
yes
cry?
I think, yeah. I in Final Fantasy VII I legit cried when Aeris died. I mean, like,
when the soundtrack comes on, you, like, shed it to, like,
she's,
I remember,
like,
that moment.
Her body just floats off into the ether and you're like, why am I fighting anymore?
Oh no. Oh my god, so gamer.
So I'm glad that we established, like, this relationship we're gonna have, where Jenna is like, oh, Final Fantasy barf, and I'm like,
well, I mean,
love
I'm more of a Counter-Strike person. I'm just like, just shoot them. Like, why you guys have to talk about feelings? Let's just shoot them.
Shoot.
Oh man, seriously, we can talk about gaming, and thanks for another whole complete episode.
Yep, yep.
And
take
so
that down.
I want to give a moment that we can have some listeners call in, and we're going to reading from the mailbag. But before that, we got a cool piece from one of David's fandoms. It's what do we like to call it, David? Futurosophy?
Future Philomorama Sophie.
Future Philomorama Philosophy.
You know, let's just let you explain it.
Take it away.
This segment I'm calling Futurosophy. Philosorama? Future Philorama Sophie? Basically, Futurama Philosophy. The idea is to take science fiction concepts featured in the second best television show ever created and to expound on them. To go beyond the novelty of a particular plot device and think about how it would actually affect our lives if achievable. The possibilities and horrors of sci-fi come to bear. This is Future Philoromosophy! That's right. I went with the longest of the portmanteaus. For this Future Philoromosophy, I'll stop saying that now, I want to discuss the concept of reset. Starting over, throwing out the past and rewriting the future. It's a doctrine interwoven throughout the Futurama series from beginning to end. Before going too far into the philosophical concepts, though, I suppose a brief explanation about what Futurama actually is warranted. In 1999, The Simpsons creator and Portland native Matt Groening launched his second animated series, Futurama. It features the adventures of Philip J. Fry, a hapless 20th century pizza delivery boy who inadvertently gets frozen for 1,000 years into the year 3000.
It's the future. My parents, my coworkers, my girlfriend. I'll never see any of them again. Yahoo!
There he meets Leela, a competent and talented space captain who happens to be a Cyclops.
What's with the eye?
I'm an alien, all right? Let's drop the subject.
Cool, an alien.
And Bender, a foul-mouthed robot who quickly becomes Fry's best friend.
The human race can bite my shiny metal ass!
Together, they meet up with Fry's great-great-great ad nauseum nephew, Professor Farnsworth, who hires them to replace his recently deceased package delivery crew for his company, Planet Express.
Are you three by any chance interested in becoming my new spaceship crew?
It's your basic workplace comedy premise, with the additional dimensions of science fiction and animation, allowing it to go anywhere the writers please. As Matt Groening puts it,
What I've done to the American family with The Simpsons, we're going to do to science fiction with Futurama.
Hopefully everything I just covered is old news to everyone listening. However, if you've not had the pleasure of watching this wonderful series yet, go. Go now and watch it. Its 7 seasons and 4 movies are only a scant 50 hours and 17 minutes long. You can knock it out in less than 3 days. You won't be disappointed. Plus, what I'm about to talk about next may contain spoilers depending on how you look at things. Now, going back to the concept of a reset, the idea of being able to start over. The reason I think reset plays so heavily in the Futurama universe is because the ideas behind space and time in science fiction are so fascinating and fun to explore. But despite all the adventures and exciting sci-fi hijinks Fry and company get entangled over the years, I think the biggest philosophical donut that hit me the most throughout its run happened in the very last episode, the episode aptly entitled, Meanwhile.
Remember this place, Leela?
Yep, the moon. It's been here for quite a while.
Yeah, but it's also where we came on our very first delivery together.
Oh, right. Man, we sure used to try harder back then.
In the episode, Leela suffers a near-death experience on a lunar carnival ride.
Seeing Leela fly off the hexadecapus and crash through the moon dome and survive inside a stuffed animal by breathing a balloon was a dose of reality.
After the scare, Fry realizes he can't spend his life without Leela and decides to ask her to marry him. It's a trope, I know, but we go with it.
I guess what I'm saying is, the next time you almost die, I want it to be as my wife.
Concurrently, Professor Farnsworth introduces his latest sci-fi gizmo.
Behold the time button, a pocket-sized device that sends the entire universe 10 seconds into the past.
But of course, through a series of unfortunate events, it is a cartoon after all, Fry and Leela inadvertently freeze time.
What happened? Did I break the button?
I think you broke the universe. Everything but us is frozen.
With all of time frozen around them, Fry and Leela decide to live out the rest of their lives together, slowly growing old and traveling the wonders the world has to offer.
To us, if I could make one moment last forever, this is the one I would choose.
I'm glad you did. It was a good life.
It's a good ending to a wonderful show. Of course, it doesn't end there. Be forewarned, I'm literally about to play the final 30 seconds of all of Futurama. Okay, here it is.
Okay, I've modded the device to release a single huge anti-chronoton blast. It should rip us out of stasis back to the instant before I conceived of the time button.
You mean we'll all get to live our lives over again?
Oh my, yes. Even that nasty robot, what's his name? Of course, we won't remember anything that's happened.
What do you say? Want to go around again?
I do.
And that's it. In about the span of 20 seconds, our two main characters basically decide to do it all over again. To wipe away everything they've experienced and done over the past few decades. They decide to hit the reset. Personally, I think the ending is wonderful. It hits as sweet, thoughtful, and unsettling as one could hope. On the one hand, it is a metaphor to life itself and makes us think about the meaning of our time and how we use it. On the other, it literally is telling the audience that, even though the series is over, Futurama's still here. Go ahead and start over. Rewatch it again and re-experience the fun and enjoyment it gave you over the 13 years of its run. But as fitting as I find the message, why do I find it unsettling? This really is the entire point of me wanting to discuss this episode and the philosophical notion of reset. What does reset really mean? If given the opportunity, such as Fry and Leela had here, could you really make that leap? Think of the ramification of their decision. They are basically willingly deciding to end everything that they know and have done for the past 50 years, wiping it out of existence and memory just to do it again. Why is that such a hard concept for me to wrap my head around? Because they are basically erasing themselves. It's death without history. It's heavy. It's an easy choice for a cartoon character, but given the same option, could I make the same one? Even under the same circumstances of Fry and Leela having lived a full and fulfilling life, could I make that leap? But isn't that kind of all of life in general? We don't know what happens when we die. For all we know, we could also reset. It's thoughts like these that circle dangerously into the classic what doesn't matter spiral. That is, if we all just die and become nothing in the end, then what's the point? But thinking like that is where I feel we miss the point. True, Fry and Leela's life ultimately was meaningless. They won't remember it, and no one will even know what even happened. But while it's meaningless, that doesn't mean it didn't have meaning to them living it. They still were able to experience the wonder and amazement the world had to offer. The love, pain, fear, heartache, loneliness, and Twitterpation that is life. They lived their lives given what they had, caring for each other and those around them. And then there's always Bender's take on the issue.
You gotta live in the moment, baby!
Okay, so that's a lot of stuff to take in. Usually I try to avoid talking about how meaningless a person's life is until the second or third date. So, to end this future philoromosophy, I thought I would go off the subject of reset and instead talk about the notion of reboot. True, the words could be interchangeable, but bear with me. If you're like all normal human beings, I'm sure there are things you've done that you regret or would like to do over again, given the additional knowledge of actually learning from your mistakes. And for any of you out there who say you have no regrets, I don't know how to talk to you.
I don't regret this, but I both rue and lament it.
To this end, I felt it was appropriate to reference another well-known geek philosopher, the internet's Will Wheaton.
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 I was reading a post from Will Wheaton's WillWheaton.net blog where he talks about rebooting himself. In his words, he writes that he had an epiphany about his life, asking himself, this thing that I'm doing, this series of choices I make every day, it isn't working. I don't like the way I feel. I don't like the way I look. I don't like the things I'm doing. Things need to change. And so Mr. Wheaton took a long, hard, serious look at himself and comprised a list of 7 things he's doing to reboot his life. They are drink less beer, read more, write more, watch more movies, get better sleep, eat better food, exercise more. Not much different from basically New Year's resolutions, but you get the point. Now, whether or not Mr. Wheaton follows through on his reboot really isn't the point. It's that as meaningless as our life may be,
my life, and by extension everyone else's, is meaningless.
We all have the capacity to make decisions on how we choose to live it. Meanwhile, this has been Future Philophilosophy. Future Philophilosophy? Future Pharmacy? Philosorama? Philosorama.
That was so deep.
We're going to, I don't know, we'll have to get a correct term on how to pronounce it.
I would propose Philosophorama.
Philosophorama.
Wow.
Yeah. Just like switch the emphasis parts.
There you go.
What do you think?
I don't know what I'm doing, so.
But getting insight from the guru Will Wheaton, that was powerful.
Will Wheaton.
Will Wheaton.
Because I'm a huge Futurama fan, and I think it's funny that when I saw that last episode, I didn't think so deeply into it. All I saw was like, oh, of course they want to have a reset extra in case that the show gets picked up again, so they want to be able to have an excuse because Futurama ended so many times and always had this sort of ending.
Yeah, they have like 3 runs.
Yeah, and so then when David talked about this idea a few weeks ago, I was like, what? That is so deep. Oh my gosh. Like, wow, Futurama has such like insight into life. And yeah, I don't know if I'd hit reset.
It's just straight up.
Yeah. It is strange because really, my thinking on it was, it doesn't really matter because we don't know. It's basically dying. Yet, why is it so hard? You know, like if you right now, let's say if it's easy, like you're in your deathbed or something, and then the choice is pretty easy. But if it's like you have to make your decision, but you don't remember. But it's basically dying anyway. So why is it so hard? It's just the knowledge that you're making that decision. I don't know. It's
Well, yeah, I think, and I might have just misinterpreted what Farnsworth was saying, but part of it was that all of it changes, like everything gets rebooted, right? Like not simply Leela and Fry, but like the universe around them, right?
They're basically going back to where the time froze and then going forward again from there. So it'll be a different life.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for me, I think it's a global effect that is really hard to swallow. Like the fact that, you know, you're making this decision and you can make a decision whether or not you continue or change or die or, you know, whatever happens to be the case. But you're also making that decision for every single thing around you. Like that thing for me is the part that like that's the sticky part. You know, like,
is that encouraging or discouraging?
I mean, it depends on your outlook, right? Like, do you want to exert control over, you know, the universe in this sort of way? Or are you, you know, like more, hey, I exist within the universe and I'm totally insignificant. So me making that choice is unethical or, you know,
it's very godlike to have that kind of power.
Yeah, right. And I think that for me is like, you know, I can accept, you know, state changes and maybe going back and having like a different experience. But, you know, having that control over everything around you in that way is uncomfortable.
Well, you know, when you put it that way, maybe I would reset because I want the power to reset the world.
I'm learning so much about you in this first episode. Wow. I love it.
Well, I think we might actually have a caller on the line. And we are going to be speaking with James. Hello, James. Welcome to a Radio Geekly.
Oh, how are you doing? This is a great show. I'm digging it. This is things that I just absolutely thrive on. People think it's ridiculous to to expand on ideas, you know, themes in stuff that we would ultimately consider like meaningless or pointless because it's animated, it has no basis in reality. But I mean, I totally get that. I totally get that. I do that all the time. My first big fandom was like Legend of Zelda.
Oh yeah. You know?
So I mean, I was the kid in elementary school when everybody else was trying to be cool and buff. I was making my own Legend of Zelda swords and boomerangs out of popsicle sticks.
You were legendary.
And popsicle sticks and duct tape. It was so. I mean, I totally get that. That was one of the things that I thought about was Majora's Mask, because you have the power. You can only go back 3 days, but it's like, no, you're the only one who remembers anything. Everybody else forgets everything around you.
Oh, interesting.
Right.
You know, and they have like really cool themes on that. Like one of them is a love story between, because you have basically these side quests, and one of the side quests is you're helping one of the main characters. His name is Nafe. He gets shrunk by he gets turned into a little kid and is unable to attend his wife's wedding that they had all planned, and you have to go through and help him. And it's one of, but anyway, point is that I dig that whole idea about time and being able to change things, and how would you do it different?
Yeah, so, totally.
I don't know. It feels kind of weird now because I was totally ready to talk about how awesome Legend of Zelda is.
Now it got like you all philosophical.
Now it's Futurama lost us awfully.
Yeah, awesome. Well, thanks, James, so much for calling, and we appreciate it. And now we've got Robert calling in. Hello, Robert. Welcome to Regular Geekly.
Hi, everyone.
Hi, Robert.
I've been really enjoying the show. So I just figured I'd call in because I found it really interesting earlier in the show when y'all were going around the table, and I think one of you was very into the exploration component of Final Fantasy, and another person at the table then proceeded to talk about, like, you know, screw that, let's just shoot each other. So
what is your take? Are you on the Final Fantasy side or what?
I do have really fond memories of Final Fantasy III in particular. Man, exploring, getting the secret characters, Mog and Gogo. Oh, God. So
high five.
Right. But I thought I'd just zoom out the conversation for a hot second because there's actually a tidbit of theory behind like the difference in preference. So it's interesting. Players come in four different types, usually, and you can technically push that to eight. This comes from a guy named Richard Bartle, really nice professor, one of the first guys in artificial intelligence in the 70s, lives in Essex. He posited that players come in four different types. Your killers that sort of go for that first-person shooter experience. Your explorers, and that would be where where the person I was talking about, like spending excess hours in Final Fantasy, that's the explorer. And then the achievers and the socializers. And it sort of helps describe why you prefer certain styles of gameplay. And that's not to say people are one or the other. Usually people are a hybrid with, you know, some form that is the preference,
like
that's backed up with the other forms. But I just thought I'd throw that into the conversation.
Yeah, that's totally cool insight. And I think I see Jenna nodding her head when you talked about killers, and Becky over here with the explorers. Yeah. I think you kind of hit the nail on the head there with those. But
it's like, you know us.
Yeah. So that's awesome. So I appreciate it, Rob. I wish we could talk to you a little bit longer, but we got to wrap up the show in the next couple minutes. But thanks so much for your insight, and I hope you tune in again soon.
Yeah, call in next time.
Yeah, we need to talk about that. What type of gamers we are.
Yeah. There's so much insight, and which leads me to kind of wrapping up the show. We are in this premiere pilot episode, so if it all goes, we get the green light from the powers that be, we will be a monthly show on Friday mornings from 11 to noon. And if you have ideas in terms of what we can talk about, you know, I think we need to go into more gaming, or why didn't you guys talk about Star Wars, or that kind of thing, you can email me. That's Jessy, J-E-S-S-Y, at KBOO.org. Oh, or if you're old school and you like to write things down on paper and ink, you can send us a letter. KBOO, care of A Radio Geekly, at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. And check back on the KBOO website for information about upcoming shows and ideas that we're kind of bouncing around. So I want to say thank you to all of my fellow geeks here, Becky, Jenna, and David, for stopping by, sharing your insight. And I want to leave us with a little bit of Trumpisms to go out on. You know, we got to throw in a little bit of hilarity.
We're super fans of audio collage too, so yeah, that's really important.
So take it away there, Sam, and next. We're going to go to the Trump there. I know we were playing our little cool theme song.
It is a cool theme song.
And I think we got some Trumpisms to be played here to round us off at the top of the hour. We also
think once we get the green light for things, we'll have, you know, a presence on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram.
All the social media things.
Yeah.
So let's just tune out.
Yeah.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Taco bowls are made in Trump Tower Grill. I love Hispanics. Money was never a big motivation for me, except as a way to keep score. The real excitement is playing the game. Oh. My fingers are long and beautiful. That's been well documented, along with other various parts of my body.